Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Last night, in a confrontational and spirited State of the Union address, President Joe Biden drew sharp distinctions between his policies and those of the Republican caucus. Jumping into his address even before Speaker Mike Johnson could utter the traditional introduction, Biden scolded members of the Supreme Court for their dismantling of the Roe decision. He criticized the Israeli government for the heartbreaking civilian casualties in its prosecution of the war against Hamas. He challenged Republicans to save Ukraine from an unprovoked Russian onslaught. And he expressed incredulity at Republican opposition to a border bill crafted by one of the Senate's most conservative members. The president's speech was by no means stumble-free, and the atmosphere in the House chamber was raucous. Decorum was in short supply. America's acute political bifurcation was on full display. With razor-thin margins for both Republicans and Democrats in the House and Senate, the down-ballot races this November have added significance. Last spring, Maryland's senior senator Ben Cardin announced he would retire next January at the end of his third term. Cardin is one of six senators who are not seeking re-election. In today's installment in our series of conversations with the candidates, we'll meet one of the two leading candidates in the Democratic primary to succeed Senator Cardin. Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks has led Maryland's second largest county since 2018. She is the first black woman to lead any county in Maryland history, and if she's elected to the U.S. Senate, she will be the first woman to serve in the Maryland congressional delegation since Barbara Mikulski and Representative Donna Edwards left office in 2017. A former prosecutor, County Executive Alsobrooks served as the state's attorney in Prince George's County from 2011 to 2018. She had been an assistant state's attorney in the county for 14 years prior to that. Her most significant opponent in the race for the Senate is Representative David Trone, a congressman from the 6th District. There are eight others who are on the ballot as well. Angela Alsobrooks is 53 years old. She lives in Prince George's County, where she was born and raised. She received a BA from Duke University and a law degree from the University of Maryland School of Law. She is the mother of a daughter who is in college. Angela Alsobrooks joins us here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well. We'll take some calls a little bit later, but you can ping us on email if you'd like right now. midday@wipr.org is our address. Madam County Executive, it's great to meet you.
It's great to meet you, and thank you so much for having me today, and to all your listeners, thanks as well for having me on the show.
Well, we're delighted to spend the hour with you. What were your impressions of the State of the Union last night and President Biden's address?
Well, you know, I think President Biden was very strong last night. I really did think he made the case for the success that both the Democratic Party has experienced and his leadership has brought us. The list of accomplishments, everything from a stronger economy through the lowering of inflation and the lower unemployment rate. I think that it was strong for him to also talk about the climate investments that we've made, a $352 billion investment. Talked a lot about also forgiving the student debt and just so many of the other accomplishments of this administration. But chief among the things that he said that really resonated with me is I loved that he reminded us who we are as Americans. He talked about decency. He talked about dignity. He talked about honesty. He talked about equality. And I think core to everything he said, that was, for me, one of the best parts of the speech is to remind us, even in turbulent times, who we are as people and most especially who we are as Americans.
And prior to the speech, a lot of the punditry was worried about sort of the mechanics of it, the performative aspects of it. They said it was up to Mr. Biden to assuage the fears of people who criticized him for being too old. They were worried about infirmity and stuff. Do you think he met those expectations? Do you think he addressed those fears?
I think he did. I think he was very mentally nimble last night. He was even humorous at times. He was strong and unflappable, I thought. I thought the message came across as strong. He was energetic. So I thought he did what he needed to in terms of not only exciting the Democratic Party and the base. I heard today Senator Chuck Schumer, who said that they were just thrilled. That he really did what he needed to as a leader. And, I think he did a really great job.
What is it about being a United States senator that appeals to you? We'll talk a little bit about why it should appeal to the voters in a minute. But to you personally, what is it about that job that you really would like?
You know, as I look out, and similar to what we talked about with President Biden, these are really difficult times. Times when so many families feel discouraged. There are people who feel disconnected and disinvested. And I think even in these moments, this is a great time for us, I think, to step forward and to have leaders who not only understand the people that they represent, who get it, who understand the daily cares and concerns of people, but who also have a record of delivering results. And for me, I think about people like my grandmother, Sarah, who was my father's mother. And Sarah was a woman who raised my dad, his two siblings, and one other family member in a one-bedroom apartment in Northeast Washington. She was a housekeeper who worked in hotels in and around D.C. And my father shared with me that she really wanted, it was her greatest desire, to work in the federal government. And as you might recall, there was a time, of course, she had to take a civil servant's exam. There was a typing test. But he told me that his mother couldn't afford a typewriter. So she put a white piece of paper on the refrigerator in the family's kitchen. She drew on that white piece of paper a keyboard and taught herself the keystrokes right there on the family's refrigerator, passed the civil servant's exam, got herself a job, and I am her legacy. And what that's meant for me is I understand that all of us want the same things for our families. We want safe places to live. We want to be able to have the single best education possible for your children. You want economic opportunity and health care. And these are the things that I've been fighting for the last 27 years. And as a senator, it's what I will continue to fight for. And I believe people need people in office who have that core understanding about what's important to all of us, and then have also the skills to make sure that you're delivering every single day for Marylanders and, by extension, for Americans who are looking for democracy and freedom. This is what excites me, is the chance to continue the work that we've had very fine senators. There's a strong legacy. You mentioned Senator Cardin, Senator Van Hollen, Senator Mikulski. Maryland has a very, very distinguished legacy where senators are concerned, and I'd be honored to continue it.
It's difficult in this politically bifurcated climate that's just never been, it seems, so acrimonious as it is now. The margins in both the House and the Democrat, both the House and the Senate, between Democrats and Republicans are razor thin. What do you see the capacity of a single senator, and in particular your capacity if you're elected, to have an impact, to make a difference in this deliberative body where people are in their camps and just seem to be so far apart from any sense of cooperation and commitment to common cause?
You know, even in these challenging times, I'm reminded of something that my father once told me. And he said to me, you know, how you see something depends on where you sit. And it was a reminder to me that a person's perspective is often shaped on your life's experiences. And it reminds me also not to demonize people who see things differently, to have a mind to hear from people, to be able to listen. And then I think if you're able to do that, which I am as a leader, I think you can find places not only to compromise, but to get things done. Even with people who don't agree with you, I can imagine that as divided as we are, there are still so many places where we can work together. And I'll be looking for those places for Marylanders to find ways to bring back every economic opportunity possible for Marylanders, to make sure that we are keeping down the cost of medications and prescriptions for more Marylanders. For, you know, we've been able to cap recently the cost of insulin for seniors. We got to do that for all of us to bring down the cost of living. I'll be looking for those opportunities to advance Marylanders and Americans. And I think you do that by working with people who don't always see it the way you do.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today, Prince George's County Executive Angela Also Brooks. It's part of our Conversations with the Candidates series. Your experience as a prosecutor, you did domestic violence cases for a long time in the Prince George's State's Attorney's Office. You served as state's attorney. You prosecuted a bunch of cases even when you're, you know, running that office. And now you're the county executive in Prince George's. How does that prosecutorial and executive experience translate in the legislative arena of the Senate?
Well, you know, I started as a domestic violence prosecutor in 1997. I absolutely fell in love with the work. And I was there defending women and families and children when I came to understand something that I think is really important to the work that I've done. And it's that there are so many people, Tom, who are in our courthouses here and across the country who are seeking second chances. And it occurred to me that so many of them had never had the first chance. And by that, I mean where we had not invested in affordable housing or addictions care or mental health care, those who were seeking economic opportunities for themselves and for their children, prenatal care and pre-K. These are the things that I saw that if we just made the investment in people, that we could really, really address so many of the systemic issues that affect our families. That's the work I've done as county executive has been to make those investments. But I think we have to go even farther. In the Senate, where we have opportunities, again, to make sure that we are providing for every Marylander the first chance of success. What that looks like across the state, I found, is very similar. When we go to the rural parts of the state, where I learned, for example, that there was a woman who said, my husband has prostate cancer, and it took us 9 months to be able to see a specialist for him. We don't have the health care we need, or we don't have the transportation network to get us to opportunities, job opportunities. We don't have the broadband to grow our businesses. There are so many places where we're missing the chance for people to be successful. And I'll be looking as a U.S. Senator for every opportunity to make sure that all of us can experience the American dream. And it starts again with those investments that I know we're able to make.
The main opponent in this race, there are 10 candidates, but basically you and David Trone, who is in Congress now representing the 6th District, he is self-funding his campaign. He's a very wealthy man. That's a big difference. We'll talk about that in a second. But in terms of policy, are there policy differences that are, you know, pretty stark between you and David Trone? It's often the case that in primary elections, people in the same parties don't really differ that much, you know, in terms of political philosophy. But can you identify places where you and Mr. Trone do differ?
Well, you know, when you talk about policy choice is an issue in this race where I am the only candidate who has not been compromised where choice is concerned. If you consider both David Trone and then Larry Hogan, who's recently come in at Mitch McConnell's invitation. And I can tell you policy is not so much about a theoretical concept as it is an action. And so I am a person who has been very clear that I believe women deserve the right to make decisions about their own bodies. And we look at Congressman Trone, who says that that's what he believes as well. However, he has made significant contributions to the campaigns of people like Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, who has made it his mission to ban abortion care, or Greg Paxton, who sued the woman who needed abortion care because her child had died in utero. Ken Paxton sued her. If we think about Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, these are people who Congressman Trone has made significant campaign contributions. And so I think it is a difference. And it's not just what you say you believe, but then how you act on what you believe. You fund the campaigns of people who don't share your values. That's something I do not agree with. There have been, you know, other differences, but that is one that is significant. And I can tell you that that I have also, by way of experience, a very different set of experience as an executive who's delivered results. And so that I understand not only the importance of creating policy, but the impact of those policies on people. I understand how critical it is to have daycare for mothers who want to be in the job market or growing families. I understand what it means for communities who don't have access to health care, how that shows itself in our families and how it translates to how our kids perform in school. And so we have a difference mainly in experience. And my experience is that of a person who has been laser focused on results and getting things done for families. And that's what I'll continue to focus on as a senator.
Turns out today is International Women's Day. And if you are elected, it would be an historic choice. There's only currently one African-American woman in the Senate. She's there as an appointed person to finish the term of Dianne Feinstein from California. It's if you're elected, it's likely you would be the only African-American woman in the Senate. That could change depending on who else wins elections around the country, but there's that chance. Why does that matter? Why is the historic nature of your candidacy important?
You know, I mean, I think there are a number of factors that voters look at when they are selecting candidates. Certainly, I think that it is important to have representation in that body, that I think all of us of every race, of every gender and every background ought to be able to look in the Senate and see themselves. I think it makes our policies more complete. We have a legislative delegation in Maryland where we have 10 members of our federal delegation and all 10 are men. We do not have a single woman representing us in Washington. And I think electing women is not just good for women, it's good for America. To make sure that as we consider policies, that we have complete solutions, we have the experiences, the lived experiences of all of us. And so that is not just true for women or black women. It's true for all of us that that we ought to have, again, of every race, every gender, and every background represented in that body. But I know that race and gender are just a couple of the factors that people may consider, but they'll also consider experience. And I think that when they consider experience, they will find that I have the best experience of anyone in this race, having not just talked about crime and justice or talked about health care, but these are affordable housing. But I have a clear record of accomplishment where each of these important issues are concerned, and I'll be able to build on that as a U.S. senator in a way that I think will be very, very important to Maryland's families and will be important to our country.
There is a stark difference between the financial resources available to Mr. Trone and those available to you. You're out there raising money like crazy, like everybody else is in public life has to do these days. How do you respond to his contention that the fact he can self-fund a campaign, and there are reports that he's, you know, ready to spend up to $53 million just on the primary, and he says by doing that himself, he is not beholden to any supporter. He's not beholden to any PAC. He's not beholden to any corporate donor. He's not beholden to any individual. He's his own man. How do you respond to that contention?
Well, you know, I think I have a record that resonates with Marylanders. First of all, they're too savvy to let anyone buy a race. And so I have a lot of confidence in Marylanders who have seen, as you've mentioned, the difference in resources. I am not a self-funder. But what I do have is a network of grassroots supporters across the state of Maryland. Those supporters are in every county across the state who have mobilized for this campaign. I have the support of people like Governor Moore and Senator Van Hollen. And in fact, I have the support of every single member of our federal delegation, except one person, who have found after considering my experience and the experience of the congressman that I'm the person they believe is best suited and best qualified to lead us in that body. That support translates across the state, and I know at the end it won't be money that will determine this race. It will be the people who will decide who will look at my experience and who will look at my look at everything I offer and will decide that I have the best experience and the best vision for Maryland to go forward. But having said that, let me just say this. I've broken fundraising records in this race. We had the single strongest opening quarter of any statewide candidate in Maryland's history. We raised $1.7 million in the first 7 weeks of the race. We closed the last quarter of this year as the strongest single quarter, close to $1.8 million. We continue to raise really at historic levels. And so this is a very well-supported campaign, financially and otherwise. And I think at the end of it, again, it will be the people who will decide this race, not money. And that's the reason that End Citizens United, for example, has endorsed my campaign, because we don't want big money, billionaires and corporations to determine these races. And I think that that will be the case in this one. We want to get big money out. We want the people to decide these races. And I think Marylanders will do just that.
Prince George's County Executive Angela Also Brooks is the candidate in the Democratic primary for the United States Senate. We'll have more with County Executive Also Brooks on the other side of a quick break. You are welcome to join us when we come back. We'll take some of your calls and emails. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show Monday, our series of conversations with the candidates continues with State Senator Sarah Elfrith. She's running to succeed Representative John Sarbanes in Maryland's 3rd congressional district in a field that includes 22 candidates, 5 of whom are members, like Senator Elfrith, of the Maryland General Assembly. So Senator Sarah Elfrith will make the case for her candidacy on Midday Monday. And this programming reminder about next Tuesday, we'll hold another Midday Town Hall with Governor Wes Moore. We have a new listener line that you can use to record a question for the governor. The number is 410-735-1616. That's 410-735-1616. And you can also send an email to midday@wipr.org to let the governor know what's on your mind. So again, our Midday Town Hall with Governor Wes Moore happens Tuesday here on WIPR. And if you've just joined us today, it's the latest installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. I'm spending some quality time with the major candidates for Baltimore mayor and city council president, the House of Representatives, and the United States Senate. All of these conversations are collected on the Midday webpage at WIPR.org. My guest today is Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. She's a candidate in the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate. The incumbent in that seat, Ben Cardin, will retire next January. To join us, we're at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. We've got a number of calls that we'll try to get to. As you mentioned, Madam County Executive Larry Hogan is the presumptive nominee for the Republican nomination. So it'll be a race that originally didn't seem like it was going to be all that interesting in the general election, but now it's going to be more than interesting. It's going to have national attention. What makes you more electable on the electability scale, because that is now something Democrats are going to be thinking about in this primary. What do you think makes your candidacy a better shot at beating Larry Hogan in November?
Well, you know, I think it was interesting. You're right that Mitch McConnell handpicked Larry Hogan, thinking that he was the Republicans' best chance to grow a majority in the Senate of the United States. What it clearly did was to place choice on the ballot, because we know that Larry Hogan has that he is not pro-choice, that he vetoed critical legislation that would have expanded abortion care in the state, and that there's a whole record that he will have to defend. And it means that the Republican Party, by the way, Mitch McConnell, then as soon as he picked Larry Hogan, also endorsed Trump. So we understand where this is going. In terms of my candidacy, I'm absolutely the best candidate to meet Larry Hogan in a general election for a number of reasons. I have a record that that I will continue to discuss with Marylanders of having made critical investments that will build families. But I think we also need people who excite the base of our party in the Democratic Party. That party includes women. It will include mothers. It will include youthful, younger people. It will include minorities. It will include veterans. It will include a wide range of people. And we need someone in that general election who not only has a record and can take that record to the voters, who has the experience to deliver in the Senate, but someone who also inspires and encourages people to come out, and someone that we, you know, I think everyone can see some of themselves. Again, I am a mother. I'm the daughter of amazing parents who I get it. I get it. I understand what hardworking families are dealing with. And I think in me that people will be able to see a lot of themselves. And I think that's going to be important.
What are, in your view, Larry Hogan's biggest strengths? And I ask that because any election where a candidate goes head to head against somebody else, you got to understand what that other person is really good at to be able to respond and to be able to, make your case in a more persuasive way. This is a guy who, after 8 years, left with a 63% approval rating among Democrats in the state of Maryland when he served as governor. He's an excellent politician, it seems to me. What do you see as his strengths and how you would counter those?
I think Larry Hogan has communicated well. I think he has around him people who are really great communicators. And they, for example, convinced Marylanders to some extent to forget his record was a record he never had to defend because his communications shop was so great. We forgot, you know, that he was a person who was not pro-choice in a state that is very pro-choice. We noticed that he not only vetoed that legislation, but was not in support of family and medical leave. He was not, for example, he's going to be a part of a party that that blocked important immigration reform. And so, you know, he oversaw a time where our school systems, where schools fell in terms of ranking, in terms of educational ranking. And so he has a record that he never had to defend because he's had really excellent people communicating. I think in a Senate race, it will be very different. Marylanders know clearly the difference between a governor and a senator, and many of the issues that will be that really we could not, this election could not be more important. As we look at the courts, for example, and this and having the ability to block these judges who are taking away our rights, everything from voting rights, LGBTQ rights and other rights, the climate, really taking action on the climate. These are all issues that will really come before the Senate, and they are ones where Larry Hogan's views do not align with most Marylanders. And so those are issues that will have to be addressed. But if you say, but the strength has been that he's communicated, but until now, I think he's going to have to communicate, and I think Marylanders will vote to keep Maryland blue.
Yeah, and you're right that, the stakes here are not just for the state of Maryland, but really for the country, and that the balance of power in the Senate could be very much, or is very much in play, and Democrats have catching up to do in this particular cycle, given who's, you know, incumbents and who's running for re-election. They got a lot of seats to defend.
And let me just say,
Maryland's all of a sudden a player in that, and oftentimes isn't.
And we're a player in the decision around choice, which is an issue, by the way, that is not only important to women. I have on this trail come to understand it's important to their husbands. It's important to their brothers. This is an issue that's important to so many who see that this is an issue about privacy and about freedom and about women's right to make decisions that control their bodies. But the Republican Party does not agree. And Donald Trump has made it abundantly clear that he wants an abortion ban, a national ban against abortion. And it is the case that Larry Hogan will vote with the Republican caucus. He will vote with the caucus on this and so many other issues of importance. And this is a concern. IVF, you know, the Republicans are not done yet. It's not just choice. It's contraception. It's IVF treatments. It's wicked. And they're not done yet. And this is a party that we cannot risk. We can't trust Donald Trump's party. The party that is controlled by Donald Trump, we cannot trust.
Our producer tells us that Janet is on the line from Towson with a question that perhaps has to do with choice. Perhaps the county executive's already answered it. But Janet, what would you like to ask County Executive Also Brooks?
Thank you for taking my call. County Executive, I found your contrast with Congressman Stone with respect to choice very interesting, and I think it's really important for voters to know how he is seriously compromised with respect to choice and women's reproductive rights. His contributions to anti-choice candidates around the country is something people should know about. But with respect to Hogan, I know that he has always tried to avoid being pinned down on the issue. Can you discuss specifically any comments that he's made that may give you a really good way to challenge him on this issue?
Thank you so much.
Yeah, go
Janet,
ahead.
Thank you so much, Janet, for calling. Yeah, I mean, you know what? Hogan came into the race and he made two really inopportune comments. The first was he said, oh, I get it, because choice is an issue that's extremely emotional for women. You know, women, we don't need any help with our emotions. It is a grave misunderstanding that it is not emotional, no more than any healthcare decision is emotional for any person. It is the right of that individual to make decisions about their healthcare. And then followed up that comment by saying, you know, he expected to be attacked because they are extremists on either side of the abortion care issue. And my retort to that would be that the only thing that is extreme about the people who have weighed in on this abortion issue is that that decision should be a decision that anyone has any input on other than that woman and her doctor. That's what's extreme, is that Larry Hogan and Mitch McConnell and the rest of these folks believe they have any say over what decisions a woman makes over her body, that's what's extreme. And so there's a profound misunderstanding that was displayed in both of those comments. But calling women emotional who are concerned about having agency over their bodies is outrageous. And it displays, I think, an ignorance that is frightening.
We understand that about 8 minutes ago, around 12:30, Larry Hogan tweeted this. Access to IVF is vital to millions of families and must be protected. I will sponsor legislation in the Senate to do just that. So Larry Hogan weighing in on IVF. And, of course, even the state of Alabama has moved to clarify what's happening there. But there are certainly Republicans in Congress and in the Senate who would like to see a federal ban on IVF the way it was articulated in the Alabama Supreme Court case. Let's stay with healthcare and go to Steve, who's calling from Baltimore. And you have, as I understand it, a question about healthcare for Angela Alsobrooks.
Just for Steve?
Yes, Steve, you're on the air. What's your question?
I'm sorry, I lost my head. So, well, the first thing, I wish that PG County person would have mentioned Sarbanes as a senator when she talked about her senators. He was very progressive. I'm wondering what progressive positions she would take on a few issues. One is if there was a bill on single-payer Medicare for all in the Senate, how would she vote on something like that? What would she co-sponsor? And also the situation in Gaza at this point in time, what she thinks.
Okay, we'll talk about both of those things, but let's stick with healthcare for the moment. So, a single payer healthcare system. You know, obviously, this was something that was very much in play in 2008 and 2012. It seems to be settled. It seems that the chances of a single payer vote are remote. But your view of healthcare, the president made mention of the fact that, you know, more people have signed up for Obamacare, the ACA, than ever before. What's your position generally on healthcare?
So, well, thank you so much, Steve, for calling. I have very good news for Steve. He was concerned about me not mentioning Senator Sarbanes. Well, his son, Congressman Sarbanes, has endorsed me and is working very hard to help me get elected. What I can tell you about healthcare is two things. One is that I absolutely believe that we need universal healthcare. And that I think the best way to the best course to get there is through a public option. And so I agree that we ought to be continuing to move toward a universal coverage, single payer. But the way to get there, I believe the first step is through a public option. I have prioritized healthcare access during my time as county executive. You've seen it in a number of ways. Opening this year, the first of its kind freestanding cancer center in Prince George's County. We were one of the only large counties without a cancer center. Also opening is at $22 million we spent to open the first of its kind freestanding mental health and addictions care facility so that we're not incarcerating people who are sick with addiction and sick with mental illness, but actually getting them the healing that they need. I'll continue to focus on healthcare access. I love, again, the work that's been done to build on the Affordable Care Act and, again, to repel the efforts of the Republican Party who want, by the way, Trump has said that it will be among his chief priorities to roll back the Affordable Care Act, the same one that allowed 22 million additional Americans to get health care, the same one that capped insulin cost and capped the out-of-pocket cost of prescription drug medications, like taking it to Big Pharma and allowing Medicare to negotiate directly with the pharmaceutical companies. I'll continue building on the Affordable Care Act and will work like everything to repel the efforts of this Republican Party led by Trump that wants to cancel the Affordable Care Act and to really abridge our rights and that we have for health care.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about foreign policy. We have some questions and some callers. Jeffrey is on the line, and he has a question about the Israel-Hamas conflict. We'll talk about it on the other side. Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks is my guest. She's a candidate in the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. We'll have more with Angela Alsobrooks after a break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. She's running for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate and the seat currently held by Senator Ben Cardin. The primary is on May 14th. Early voting starts May 2nd. His principal opponent, or her principal opponent, I should say, in that race is 6th District Representative David Trone. I spoke with Congressman Trone in January. You can access that interview and all of my interviews with candidates for a range of offices on the Conversations with the Candidates page at WIPR.org. County Executive Alsobrooks will be with us until the top of the hour. You are welcome to be with us as well. 410-662-8780, our email midday@WIPR.org. Let's go to Jeffrey, who's on the line from Pikesville. We do want to talk about the Israel-Hamas conflict. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. How would County Executive Alsobrooks get along as Senator with Chris Van Hollen, who has been dreadfully weak on Israel?
All right, and Senator, so the question is, the contention from Jeffrey is that Senator Van Hollen's been weak on Israel. He has called for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Your position on the Israeli-Hamas conflict.
So thank you so much for calling, Jeffrey. Let me just talk to you about what I believe regarding the situation in Gaza. You know, I think all of us watched October 7th and were horrified. And so we recognize that the threat of Hamas absolutely has to be removed from the world. I've been keeping abreast of the daily the updates, and what we know in this moment is that we have to get the hostages back home to their families. I've been watching the families who are just beyond distressed, and then we have to get to ceasefire. So we have to return the hostages immediately, ceasefire, so that we can get really important aid, humanitarian aid, into the Palestinians in Gaza. We see that there is a humanitarian crisis that is developing by the moment. I really was heartened to see the president mention last night that we would be organizing a pier there being able to get that aid into Gaza. And I think, you know, it is my great hope that we can afterwards reach a point where we are, as difficult as it is, moving toward the two-state solution that will allow peace and security for Israelis. And that we will have as well peace and self-determination and security for the Palestinians in Gaza. I know that this is that it is more and more challenging for that to happen. But I think in order for it to happen, we need a good partner. And, you know, and looking out, I think that it is increasingly the case. I think many Israelis feel it, and many here do as well, that we're concerned that Netanyahu may not be the best partner in order for us to be able to achieve the peace and security, again, that is needed and deserved by the Israelis, who deserve to live in peace, as well as the Palestinians in Gaza.
So setting aside the fact that it's an open question whether or not the Republicans in the Senate and the House will move forward with funding for aid to Palestinians, aid to Israel, aid to Ukraine, putting that aside, should aid to Israel, given the conduct of the war to date, continue? Should it be premised and conditional on certain, criteria that the United States could dictate? There are those who say, you know, President Biden with one phone call could end the aid, you know, immediately and just simply tell Benjamin Netanyahu that the prosecution of the war has just been too brutal when it comes to civilian casualties on the Gaza Strip. So should the legislature, should the Senate, you know, be involved in developing conditions for aid to Israel?
You know, Israel is an ally of the United States. And, you know, I agree with President Biden's and we have several allies. Israel is an ally. We have Ukraine as an ally. We have Taiwan as an ally. And I agree with President Biden's urgency that we need to do everything in our power to stop the killing of civilians in Gaza. I also agree with the insistence and the urgency as well around getting the humanitarian aid that is necessary. I think that he's right in saying that Israel has a right to defend itself and has a responsibility to make sure that we are not killing civilians and that we are likewise allowing aid into the Palestinians in Gaza who need it. And I believe that that is the right posture for us to be taking as they continue to try to rid the world of Hamas. But I think that we also need to make sure that civilians are not killed and that we absolutely, the United States and everyone else across the world, has a moral obligation to make sure that we are dealing with the humanitarian crisis that is developing as well.
Angela Also Brooks is my guest. She is the county executive in Prince George's County. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today it's another of our conversations with the candidates. 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. I do, before we go back to the phones for some other calls, I want to ask you about immigration. Clearly, it's a baffling issue. Senator James Lankford from Oklahoma, one of the most conservative members of the Senate, crafted over a four-month period a very what is considered to be, you know, the most conservative border bill to come across the Congress in decades, and the Republicans walked away from it. Baffling how they did that. The president chided them about that last night. As a member of the legislative body, you know, the other house, the Senate, were you in the Senate right now, what do you think you could do as a senator to move the needle on getting aid getting this bill passed or something like it passed in the Congress?
Well, you know, we really need people in the Senate who are, again, results oriented and who are not there playing games. You know, this bill that we talked about would have accomplished all the things we said were important: aid to Israel, aid to Ukraine, and important immigration reform that the Republicans said they wanted. They said they wanted tougher measures at the border that would have helped us to deal with the crisis there. And this would have been one of the toughest and most comprehensive packages of immigration reform we've seen in decades that would have allowed us the things that are needed, making sure the funding is there to deal with Border Patrol. We need also to have expedited ways to seek to deal with asylum claims. And this would have been possible through the bipartisan legislation to deal with the issue at our border. And with the snap of a finger, Donald Trump said that he did not want a solution at the border. He wanted a crisis because he thought this would have aided him in his reelection. And so we need real leadership, again, in this moment where we are accounted on not only aid to Israel, but aid to Ukraine, which is fighting against the dictator, the murderous and thug-like dictator, Vladimir Putin. We can't allow the Ukrainians to fail and can't allow, our allies to fail. So the Republicans, you know, again, under Donald Trump's leadership, backed away from immigration reform bills, a bill that they said they wanted, and they abandoned it, walked away from it.
As Prince George's County Executive, you changed the way that Prince George's County law enforcement interacted with federal immigration officials, ICE, et cetera. We don't have a whole lot of time left, but can you briefly tell us what your position was in that regard and how that would inform your view of immigration now?
So I think that what we did with the 287G agreement was not to enter it, and to say that people who were charged with violent offenses, those people could be, we would notify ICE with people who had been charged with violence and charged that those people would be we would notify ICE to pick those individuals up upon release. What we did not want was for people who were accused of minor and traffic infractions and things like that to be penalized for those things. But we wanted violent offenders to be ICE to be notified in the case of violent offenders.
All right, and let's move on back to the phones to try to get as many constituents as possible. Here's one from Prince George's County. Chanda is on the line. Welcome to the show with Angela Alsobrooks.
Hi, thank you, County Executive Alsobrooks, for sharing your track record of how you continue to move Prince George's County forward. I just have a question for you. Have you ever worked to get things done on a federal level?
I certainly have, Chanda. So thank you so much for that question. First of all, I was very proud to work with Congressman Steny Hoyer to bring back the federal headquarters, national headquarters, to Prince George's County. To have that located in our county is an economic, it is a game changer. 7,500 jobs, cybersecurity and technology will come as a result of it. I was also able to work along with Senator Van Hollen and others to draw, as well as our governor, to draw close to $100 million in new dollars to the New Carrollton Metro Station, a combination of raise grants that we've never gotten, federal raise grants that we've never gotten in Prince George's County before, to build out that transit hub, as well as to get a raise grant for the very first time for the Central Avenue Connector Trail to build out the new Blue Line Corridor. So I have worked on to bring back federal resources to Prince George's County, working with our federal partners to do that, to also have gotten funding for our summer jobs program. We've been able to really work with our federal delegation to bring back resources to our county, and I'll continue that as a senator, to be laser-like, to focus on those resources for the whole state.
In our last 45 seconds here, Republicans talk about three big issues when they talk about Democratic rule: crime, immigration, and inflation. When it comes to crime, what are the federal remedies? You're a former prosecutor. What are the federal remedies that you see are necessary to address whatever crime is out there?
Well, I think we need sensible gun legislation. We need to, first of all, ban these AR-15s and other military-style assault weapons. We need also to have the gun show loophole closed. We need red flag laws. These are things I've worked on as in the state legislature. We need also to have the George Floyd and Policing Act passed. So we got to eliminate the filibuster to make sure that we can have important legislation actually get through the Senate. So those are some of the things that I think we really need, is to make sure that we are having both justice and freedom, laws that are transparent and open, and that people ought to work, live in places that are safe, and that all of us have a right to live in safe communities.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have, and very much appreciate your coming by and talking, and good luck out there on the trail, and we will stay in touch.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. She is a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Senator Ben Cardin, who's retiring after three terms. That's it for today's installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. Our series continues next week on Monday. I'll speak with State Senator Sarah Elfrith, who's running for Congress in the 3rd District. And next Tuesday, we'll hold another midday town hall with Governor Wes Moore. We have a new listener line you can use to record a question for the governor. That number is 410-735-1616. And up next, special programming for Women's History Month, Buildings Speak, Stories of Pioneering Women Architects, from PRX. Midday's director and engineer is Shania Mapson. Luke Spicknell is WYPR's operations manager. Taria Rogers and Mallory Pinker-Pierre produce our program. They get help from Sam Burmistaws and Izzy Bavis. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the midday theme music. And finally, don't forget, we spring forward on Sunday morning. Set your clocks 1 hour ahead. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.